4 weeks later, we thought that we were about to find Danny. The police and FBI agents came back to my house and all their faces just crestfallen. One of the police officers turned to Marianne and said, "I'm sorry I couldn't bring your Danny home." Indeed, what I learned then in the next minutes was they had watched a video in which Danny had been slain. He had been beheaded. And these men, in the name of my religion, had taken from him his breath, you know, his voice, the light in his eyes, the Kundalini spirit, whatever word you want to call it, his lifeline. That's when I had my greatest conflict that I could never have even imagined with the faith into which I was born.
Greetings and a warm welcome to all of you to Intersections. Our aspiration here is to dissolve all kinds of boundaries. And I can't think in some ways of a more powerful boundary to dissolve than that between our individual self and the infinite, between us, if you want to call it, and the divine. And that is going to be a core part of the life journey and the story that we're going to hear from today in our guest, who I am so joyful and inspired to bring into our midst, Ashra Namani, acclaimed journalist, a researcher, an author, a speaker, civil rights leader, and an award-winning educator as well in journalism. She has taught journalism at Georgetown University, reported for the Wall Street Journal, and currently serves as a senior contributor for The Federalist, a senior fellow in the practice of journalism for the Independent Women's Network as well. As an expert in investigative reporting, writing, editing, storytelling, amongst the books that she has written is, for example, Standing Alone, An American Woman's Struggle for the Soul of Islam, which is something that we'll dive deeper into. She's the co-founder of the Muslim Reform Movement, a global coalition of Muslim reformers dedicated to peace, human rights, and secular governance. Her work has been featured on both national and international media outlets, including the Washington Post, New York Times, Time Magazine, PBS, CNN, BBC, and Fox. Ashra, please join us. It's a joy to have you.
Thank you so much. I'm so happy to be with you and really looking forward to our conversation, because I am with you in wanting to cross boundaries so that we can reach that higher place in life.
I can feel that just in your presence, your spirit, just your voice. Behind that lies a lot. Very soulful human journey that you have been on. I remember, I think it was Malcolm X who said, I just have to hear somebody's voice, he said, and I can tell so much about their character. Oh. So much about their character. So we think communication is a lot about the linear flow of words and the processing of thoughts, mm-hmm. but sometimes it's just in the sound of somebody's voice. There's actually a lot being communicated subtly in terms of the inner flow of feelings and, you know, thoughts.
Yeah, you know, you're so right, because in our voice is our breath, right? And in our breath is our being, because so much of how we even live our life is in our breath. It's captured in whether we dare to breathe throughout our system, whether we are stuck, you know, somewhere at the top with anxiety and fear. And I know you have a practice of meditation and breathing that you've woven into your life. And it's more than that external breath, because it then becomes your being in this world. And I appreciate that you can connect to my voice too.
Yeah, you know, it's funny. I mean, while that's physiologically is so true and in some ways obvious, I had actually never really connected the dots between those two. That, you know, while I have this fascination about, you know, the voice as a signature aspect of our identity, and then the breath, of course, is so central to so many spiritual traditions. You bring them together, because to your point, I mean, the voice emanates from the, you know, from the breath. So cool. Thank you. You've just educated me right here. And I mean, you know, another way to think about it, I think about it sometimes, is how nature is just whispering to us always, you know, its hidden truth. And one of those to me is that if the voice is so unique and distinctive, you know, to who you are, then perhaps it's a sign that there is something very, very special and very unique to you And don't allow the world to get you be made to think that you're only, if you want to call it like this identity or that identity, just like another, you know, 20 million people. Yes, but perhaps even more than that, you're unique, you're special. You have something which every 8 billion people in their own ways have of their own unique divine spark. I don't know. What do you think of that?
As you're speaking about it, I just think about voice then as a metaphor for our being. I love that point that you're making, because I actually haven't thought about it myself as an expression of who we are. We oftentimes think about the words that we say. What you're, you know, reflecting back to me about the vibration, really, that's another dimension of voice. But when I think about it, I think too about how it's a reflection of our breath. And then it's also a reflection of our brain circuitry, because the truth is, as you know, language and processing is in our brain, and it's in one part of the brain. But then the way that we manifest our communication is reflected in how our brain is working. So are we tapping the rage and the anger and the trauma that is, you know, in the back of our brain and part of our brain? Are we only tapping that, or are we having our own thought process include the entire circuitry, right? Which means that we process even our emotions through some prefrontal activity that is logic. That also reflects in our voice, because we know the difference between rage and anger, and you can see it in the eyes. And I have a story I want to tell you in a few minutes. Yeah. Back to your hometown, right, of Chandigarh. It's your hometown.
Chandigarh is my hometown. Yes.
Yeah. So it's Chandigarh. In which state is it in India?
Yeah. So Chandigarh is the capital of two states, actually. So it's at the intersection of those two, Punjab and Haryana.
Yes, that's what I was confused about. So I'm going to bring this all to life for you right now. So I brought this symbol for myself of
look at that.
Yes.
For those who are only hearing this podcast, I just want to highlight Astra is holding up. Actually, why don't you describe it, Astra?
So this is a symbol of a goddess in Hindu culture, in Hinduism, and it's Durga is her name. And she rides on this tiger as she's sitting, I guess what they call in America, side saddle. And she's wearing a sari, a beautiful red sari. And she's got one foot across, her right foot is across on the knee of her left foot. She has her right hand up in a gesture of openness. And she wears a crown. She has in her hand a sword of symbolism. And I have this before me because I listened to your podcast with Melissa from the toy company. I don't even know Melissa's last name because Melissa Bernstein. To me.
Yeah.
It's her last name.
Bernstein.
Okay, great. Thank you. So my son grew up on her toys, and I listened to the podcast that you just had with her, in which she reflected on her own journey. And I thought to myself, when I talked to you, I wanted to bring Durga as a symbol of my journey. So what happened for me is, we'll give everyone the backstory on how I ended up in Delhi in 2000, working on a book. I was pursuing a study of Buddhism and Hinduism, and I wanted to travel on my own. I wanted to be navigating my own journey. But I knew that the roads were a little too narrow for me to manage a car, I felt, because, you know, they just, as you know, the roads back then in 2000, like, you'd be right next to another car in the other lane. So I got a motorcycle instead. And in Lucknow, which is where I have family, I went to the Honda dealership and convinced them to sell me a Hero Honda Splendor, which, do you know that motorcycle?
Yeah, because I had been riding a motorcycle myself when I was in my final years of high school and then early years of college. And I had a Suzuki, you know, which was the competing.
But Hero Honda Splendor is 100 cc. I don't know what your Suzuki
was. Even mine was, I have to confess.
Like about 100 cc, right?
Yeah.
Which in America, like, I think mopeds are 100 cc. They won't even let 100 cc. I think sometimes on highways here. But, you know, I enjoyed it because in the state of Uttar Pradesh, which is where Lucknow sits, a lot of the bad boys drive these Hero Honda Splendors. And I was like, okay, I'm going to channel that. And I cut my hair so that I would not look like a girl underneath the helmet. And so I was wearing the studs helmet, learning how to ride the motorcycle, doing circle eights around these sleeping cows on this cricket field, not far from Hazrat Ganj, the marketplace. So I learned to ride my motorcycle, took it to Delhi, and I was doing circles around golf links, this neighborhood, practicing. And then I got on the road because I was going to go to these temples that are called Shakti Peeths. So Peeth is a divine place. And then Shakti, you know that word, of feminine energy. And there was one that I was going to hit. And my road was included Chandigarh. Yeah. So I ended up at the famous Rose Garden of Chandigarh. Yes. And I stopped for chai. And there I met this couple. And they looked at me. They listened to me, as you're saying, about voice. And they said, we can see the kundalini in your eyes, right? And the kundalini is that energy, that male or female energy, but that energy within us that we can unleash, you know, within ourselves and into the world. And I'm just telling you that story because I thought of it as I was listening to Melissa's interview and thinking about you coming from Chandigarh and how it is that exactly like what you're saying, you know, it, that being about us can be reflected, you know, in our eyes, in our voice, and it is about that integration within us.
It's just so nice that, you know, we have that point of intersection in the story with the Rose Garden and in Chandigarh. How nice. And yet, in that journey, you also evoked for us the ultimate journey, and that's the journey of the Kundalini, you know, that activating force and, you know, energy within us that can take us to places of higher consciousness and perhaps ultimately to, you know, even undreamed of, you know, places. So amazing that you had that interaction there with those people. And, you know, knowing a little bit, Ashra, about sort of your life from the outside in, and today having a chance to learn it directly from you, can you share with us a little bit more about, you know, those years in your life, because they were so remarkable in what you pursued, what you experienced, how you processed it, and where you emerged from it. And I'm thinking about even, you know, perhaps it must have happened within the next year of that, right? That there was the Maha Kumbh Mela and your moment there with the Dalai Lama. I thought that would be a really powerful thing for us to talk about for a few minutes. Are you open to that?
I'll give the backstory. Like, who was this person who was now on a motorcycle? It was a long journey to get on that motorcycle. I was born in India, as you know, in Bombay. Spent my first 4 years in Hyderabad. I lived with my parents in my grandparents' home, in my dadi and dada, my paternal grandparents' home, as is the tradition in India. I have an older brother. And like you, my dad, just a couple decades earlier, in 1960s, came to the U.S. for the same intention as you, for his education. He got his PhD at Rutgers University and then brought my mom over. And then when they settled, they brought my brother and me over. So at the age of four, I came to the United States. And like, you know, so many immigrant children and so much of humanity, actually, you know, worked for the next decades on figuring out who I am, this Muslim girl, growing up then in West Virginia and becoming a journalist. I knew not a word of English when I came to the U.S., but then because of the opportunities in America, at the age of 23, I got a great opportunity to work at the Wall Street Journal, and I covered the airline industry, international trade, you know, all these highbrow, you know, big beats, rubbing shoulders with Richard Branson from Virgin Atlantic and architects of, you know, these big airline companies, Carl Icahn, who bought TWA and destroyed TWA. I never covered Donald Trump, but was covering industry at that time of mergers and acquisitions that was really just turning people's lives upside down, I could see, because... And I could see it as a reporter, because when we would write our articles about big purchases or Pan Am is declaring bankruptcy, we would lead with the issue of the assets, you know, and their projected earnings. And then second, third, fourth paragraph would be about the human beings that would be losing their jobs. And you know this so well as a expert about how businesses run themselves. And you remember the 80s and the 90s and, you know, how much that was the era when vulture capitalism became a concept. And that was the world I was in. Just as the last century was ending, I said, I need to do something different. And I ended up getting this book contract to report about this spiritual philosophy called Tantra, or Tantra, as people call it in the United States. It had become big in America on the sale of tantric sex by experts and Marie Claire and Cosmopolitan and GQ. They'd all have their tantric experts. But I went on this journey back to India, my birthplace, in order to really understand the philosophy. I ended up, as you mentioned, the Maha Kumbh Mela is one of the biggest gatherings of spiritualism in Hinduism. I ended up going completely down the spiritual path. And it was there on the banks of the Ganga River then that I first saw the Dalai Lama. And that's where I heard these words from him, where he said, you know, what he encourages everyone to do is find peace with the religion of their birth rather than adopting a new religion or converting into a new religion. And I thought that was really a lesson of congruence, guidance of congruence within ourselves. I kept on the road, and that's when I got the motorcycle and ended up at the Rose Garden of Chandigarh.
So there was an outer professional sort of pursuit with the writing of the book, but it sounds like you were also like doing a really deep like inner journey in trying to kind of like figure things out for yourself. You just mentioned how his words about going to attune yourself with your own faith rather than, you know, take on another faith was an important lesson for you. So at that point, were you not feeling that perhaps settled in on the faith side?
Yeah, that's such a great way of putting it. So at that point, you know, I was had gone through my 20s and I was just struggling in how I was going to find congruence in my identity as an American Muslim woman, because the reality that I was experiencing was one in which my parents were 100% affirming of my identity and my life and my profession. There were, you know, definitely issues of identity that they had very definite opinions about that I was struggling with. My father especially, you know, had a real desire for me to marry only within my religion, because that was the edict for women, especially within Islam, that you can only marry within the faith. And this is for women and men in many faiths, of course. But that put, you know, this inner struggle in me, because here I was in the United States and, you know, most of my friends were non-Muslim. And I started secretly dating men that because I wasn't really in my socially conservative Muslim family allowed to date. So I was living a double life. And I think that was something that I didn't know how to reconcile. And it caused great depression. It caused great anxiety. It is something that I now recognize is a very, very painful way to live. And that's why, you know, at that age, when I was coming of age in the 80s, like I connected very deeply to people within the gay community who were in the closet, because in my own heterosexual life, I was living in the closet. And I got married for a millisecond to the man that I thought I was supposed to marry. He was a Muslim Pakistani man. And I fell in love, you know, the idea of love with him, but it was a complete mismatch of values in life. And this is where I learned in my late 20s that especially when you're on this journey of society that does value the individual, you know, ultimately you cannot really even betray yourself. And so In my experience as a 27-year-old, I would lay my head to rest every night weeping because I felt such a pain about this life choice that I had made, but one I was forcing myself to commit to do what I should do, right? And on the eve of my engagement, I even fell ill with 105-degree temperature with pneumonia. Can you imagine at, you know, the age of 27, right? Because my body was rejecting this choices. And that's so much of, as you know, meditative practice is to recognize, you know, the signs of our body. We started this conversation talking about voice, but indeed voice reflects our inner self and our inner being, that ethereal kundalini energy also. And I didn't listen and proceeded with this marriage because I thought I needed to do that. I had to do that. And in fact, the great lesson I learned from my beautiful parents when, you know, it came to collapse, this marriage, and my entire being came to collapse with depression, is they cared about me. You know, my dad came to me and he said, "I want to save you, not the marriage." That's this lesson that I learned from my parents that I wanted to share with you, that I enjoyed listening to you talk about your father also, is in their life, they model so often values that we don't even fully appreciate. But I now recognize as having been life-changing for me, and that was this principle of unconditional love and divine love, you know, like this transcendent divine love. They had expectations. They did the best that they could do. But ultimately, like, we navigated our lives together in a place of love and acceptance. And so when that marriage fell apart, my mom was there, my father was there to save the being of who I was. And then that became the young woman who ended up with this book contract to go to India. I was trying to reconcile the very patriarchal, domineering expectations within so much of my Muslim culture that I had found in such conflict with what I wanted to be in this world with my own choices. And that's how I ended up then in India exploring Buddhism, Hinduism, because I think what happens is that you can come to peace with that which you're struggling with sometimes by going outside of your own self and then absorbing lessons that you can then bring back. And that's what the journey that I ended up on there on the motorcycle.
Mother Teresa, very devout in a Christian faith and practice. You know, I really love this thought from her. She said something like, "I love all faiths and I am in love with my faith." I see a little bit of that, right? In the being in love with all faiths kind of thing that you just shared, right? In your curiosity, quest, attunement to looking for truth and insight from different sources. We haven't yet come to that point where you start to like fully be at peace with your faith. So let's sort of keep progressing in the arc of your life story. Around that time, there was also this very painful international episode in which you somehow found yourself privately almost at the very center of that story. The very sad kidnapping and killing of Daniel Pearl, the Wall Street Journal journalist. Could you talk about what that moment was and how you found yourself in it and what it led to for you?
Yeah, you know, I'm smiling because as you said Danny's name, I was remembering standing at the banks of the Ganga River texting Danny saying, "You've got to come here to the Maha Kumbh Mela. It's amazing." We had become fast friends in the Washington, D.C. Bureau. After that failed marriage, Danny had arrived at the Washington Bureau as a new reporter. And I was going through therapy in which I was learning this important lesson that whenever we say to ourselves, "Oh, I should do that," ponder a moment what you want to do, right? And so I was going through that exercise with my therapist, trying to make decisions moving forward that would reflect more of who I wanted to be in this world. So Danny arrived, and Danny became this great friend who introduced me to a lot of American society that I had never experienced as a good Muslim girl growing up in the United States. And the most innocent of things, like going out to open mic night. I had my first taste of beer. I loved playing the sport of volleyball. And so Danny and I would spend the weekends behind the Lincoln Memorial on these sand courts. And I got to literally fly, you know, across the sand and just enjoy life. And so that was my buddy. You know, it was in Pakistan after the tragedy of the September 11th attacks that Danny and I found ourselves both as journalists in Pakistan. He was there for the Wall Street Journal, and I was still out on book leave. So I was writing for Salon Magazine. And, you know, when I started off my book project, I thought divine love was going to be in a partner, right? A man, a soulmate for life. That's what I was thinking. And Danny was on that quest with me. He had found his soulmate in a young woman named Marianne in Paris. And Danny and Marianne were both in Pakistan together. And Danny sent me one email where he said, "I know there's a war going on, but can I still look for your husband in Pakistan?" And I was like, "All right, dude, go for it. Whatever you can do." I ended up falling in love with a man in Pakistan, renting a home in Karachi. And Danny told me in late January 2002 that he was coming to visit because he had a big interview. So I was so excited. I got that room fixed for Marianne and him. And Danny arrived on January 22nd, 2002 with his wife. And he had this big interview the next day. I got a car for Danny to go off for the interview and stood in front of the house that I had rented on this place called Zamzama Boulevard, which is Zamzam is this holy water in Islam in the city of Mecca. And that was when the entire rest of my life was determined and Danny's life, because that was the last time we saw him. He went into that car and he never came back. He didn't show up that night for dinner. As many people will know, but young listeners and viewers may not know, Danny was kidnapped by Muslim extremists who called him first a spy for the CIA. And then when it was discovered that he was Jewish, they called him a spy from Mossad, the Israeli intelligence agency. And then for me, I ended up suddenly becoming a spy for the government of India. And we were in this diabolical plot to shame the government of Pakistan, according to the stories now leaked into the Pakistani newspapers. And so, you know, everything that we were just talking about related to identity, it just came home. We were being judged by our identity, Danny being Jewish, me being Indian, me even as a woman, I was called Danny's assistant, you know, because in that universe, I couldn't be his equal. And that was when I felt firsthand how identity can be used as a death sentence, because then in the days that followed, the refrain kept growing and growing about Danny as an enemy of the state. And 4 weeks later, we thought that we were about to find Danny. The police and FBI agents came back to my house and all their faces just crestfallen. One of the police officers turned to Marianne and said, "I'm sorry, I couldn't bring your Danny home." And indeed, what I learned then in the next minutes was they had watched a video in which Danny had been slain. He had been beheaded. And these men, in the name of my religion, had taken from him his breath, you know, his voice, the light in his eyes, the Kundalini spirit, whatever word you want to call it, his lifeline. And that's when I had my greatest, greatest conflict that I could never have even imagined with the faith into which I was born. Challenged also on a very personal level, because I had fallen in love and not having gone through life's rituals in the order that my traditional Muslim society demanded, I discovered in the days before we discovered Danny had been murdered that I was pregnant, and my boyfriend bailed on us. He fled and saw suddenly, you know, I was a pregnant woman without a wedding ring. And the concept that you talk about boundaries is very deep and enshrined in law. In Pakistan, a boundary, the sacred boundary, is now turned into something called hudud laws. So hudud means that sacred boundary. And I had violated the sacred boundary, making me a criminal in Pakistan. So because of this life within me now. And so Hitendra, you know, it with murder and then with life, that was when I had the greatest confrontation with my faith.
Wow, there's so much to process there. Thank you for recounting what I'm sure only brings a heaviness of heart. And yet he sounded like such a beautiful, you know, soul, Daniel. I can't even imagine what it must have been like, you know, in that moment. I know the many in the world were in a state of shock when that was discovered. I remember that moment in the news, but like you were right in the middle of that, yeah, swirl of madness. Let's progress the story, because here you are at this moment where you are really confronting your religion and not liking what you see in some of the aspects that were playing out for you and what happened to Daniel. And what do you do next in a moment like that?
What I was saying Durga carries, you know, is this sword, right? And it's, to me, very symbolic, because what happened, as you know, in Danny's murder was these men took a knife to Danny's neck and they detached that part of him, you know, that makes him alive, for one. They took his life from him. And I know that, you know, in Hinduism that there is that imagery of slaying, but it is symbolic of the slaying of ego, right? And these men thought that in slaying Danny in that brutal way, they would expunge him, right, from this world. But what he did in those last moments was he laid claim to his identity as a Jewish ancestor of Israel, his parents being Jewish. And in him, you know, in those moments of the video, when I watched it again and again and again as a investigator trying to know the hand of the man who held the knife, I had my own meditation, because I think, you know, how deeply in also spiritual practice we meditate upon death, you know, not in a dark way, but in as a vehicle to reflect and then get to a place of impermanence, right? To recognize that which we have in this world is not permanent, and to get to that place of non-attachment. It was stuff that I was reading about, but it was in Danny's last moments and in the way that they killed him, but his spirit transcended, that I really got these deep, deep lessons. And I just mentioned that because I came back to the United States, and those parents that had been with me through one dark moment of my life were with me again. I came back to my hometown of West Virginia, and I was grappling with one of the greatest burdens that we can have on our spirits, I think, in this world, and that is shame internalized. Even when the world may want to shame you, or in Pakistan, I was considered a criminal for crossing the sacred boundaries. I had a choice in my own self on whether I was going to internalize those messages, and I did. I internalized them through my pregnancy, and it was my mother who freed me in constant conversation and reflection, saying I didn't have to live with shame. But it was then finally in my son's birth that I saw the divine, you know, that divine love that I had thought I was going to realize with a man. I knew as a mother that kind of love where you know it is impermanent, because hopefully your child will outlive you, you know, and you will have to leave the child one day. They will leave you, but you give them love unconditionally and fully, knowing that there will be an impermanence to it. And I felt that, you know, for my son, the moment I had him in my arms, and shame was evaporated. So with this new certainty, but yet uncertainty about how I was going to manifest it in my life, I went on the pilgrimage to Mecca with my parents, my niece, my nephew, and my newborn baby. And Mecca, as most people know, is the birthplace of Islam. And it was there that I walked in the footsteps of the women who had been, you know, pioneers within the religion. The mother of Islam really should be considered to be this woman named Hagar in Christianity and Judaism, and Hajar in Islam. I finally kind of rethought her narrative and her hero's journey, like you talk about, you know, encouraging in your students. She was a mother who was left in the desert in Mecca without a 24-hour Walmart like I got back in Morgantown, West Virginia, just herself and her own resilience. And it was, you know, in that desert sand that the story goes that her son Ishmael kicked up this spring of water, Zamzam, that my street in Karachi was named for. And it was there. I don't know if you've seen, but you know, the mosque in Mecca, the holy mosque in Mecca, is not just some like mosque. It is a multi-storied marble floor, chandelier lit creation. And I ended up on the top floor with the stars above me. And it was there that I could feel the pulse of the Hajar and generations of women who may not have always overcome, you know, that the barriers that they faced in their life, but persevered. And that's when I, you know, really felt the pulse of my ancestors, my grandmothers on both sides, my nani, my dadi, my mother, and her journey of strength and power over the traditional expectations. And it was there that I really came to understand that, you know, we had to challenge the patriarchal and traditional doctrine, mostly created by men, that did not treat women as equal citizens. And that was the lesson that I came back to the United States with, to discover that my dad was helping to start a new mosque, build a new mosque. And I was so excited then by the year's end, when the mosque opened, to go there with my son. But when I went to the front door, this elder told me, "Sister, take the back door." And there, wearing the same headscarf that I had worn in Mecca, I had to make this choice about whether I was going to go around the corner by the dumpster and go up the back stair to the balcony where they expected women to sit. And there then, Hitindra, that's when she kind of challenged my inner Durga, you know, and channeled her. And I stepped forward. And I knew that that step forward was going to unleash a lot of new dynamic in my community. But I did it because I had this clarity now of congruence with who I wanted to be in the world and who I am.
So I'm hearing just so many powerful aspects to the journey so far, and you brought us to a certain crescendo point. We have to obviously get the scoop of what happens next. But before we even go there, it sounded to me like Hajj was, you know, that pilgrimage to Mecca was a particularly transformational moment for you in getting to perhaps, maybe if I understand you correct, like understand some of the deeper truths in your religion that otherwise from the outside may have, you know, not been assimilated or processed. And when you see those deeper truths, you actually see the religion as something that you're deeply attuned with and connected with and want to perhaps really make as the foundation. Is that sort of what I'm taking away from that piece versus some of these outer kind of signs of how women have been treated, or how in that moment, you know, painfully so, Daniel was treated?
Yes. I knew that there were fundamental philosophies that were not congruent with the 21st century. And I didn't know how to manage them intellectually and then spiritually. But I came with a process then. And being a journalist and a researcher, I ended up, you know, talking to all of the most progressive scholars in the Muslim community today, and learned about concepts like ijtihad, which is an Arabic word that means critical thinking, that was a hallmark of our Muslim communities, you know, through the 8th, 9th, 10th century. But then the purveyors of ijtihad were massacred as they were facing within the community, you know, very strict interpreters of the faith. And that was the critical moment when they say that the gates of ijtihad were closed. That's like a huge, huge setback. And of course, all societies have grappled with that, right? There are dark ages in all communities. But I finally got to understand intellectually. And that's where I, you know, when going back to what we were talking about earlier, like just being a lay student of our brains, I do appreciate how much we need to integrate like our emotion with intellect, because I was feeling emotionally the disconnect. I was feeling a trauma also, right? A real tragedy that could have put me in a place of hate, anger. And I had it, like, trust me, I had it. And I was processing it. I was trying to understand it. But then using all that I had been offered in this world in terms of brain processing, I went and I was able to find a way in my own self to manage that hurt and that trauma and that wound, to come up with a new reality that could not only bring healing to myself, but to the world, and also to so many Muslims and to my younger self. Because who was I as a young woman in my 20s? I was a young woman who was hostage to those patriarchal expectations that I marry the man that my community expected me to marry, not the man that I wanted to marry. And so I knew that simple dynamic, you know, defined the lives of, you know, half of our community. I don't ever impose upon other people my path, but I want to just have opportunity for anybody to walk the path that they wish. And so that's when I learned that indeed in the 7th century when Islam was formed, women did not take a back door. They did not sit in a separate area. They were not even required to cover their hair. That, you know, women had new agency in the society that was built around Mecca and then later Medina. And I realized that centuries of male interpretation had given us this, you know, under status that we were now experiencing. And that's when I really, you know, realized like, hey, we need to have a new school of jurisprudence. We need to have a new school of interpretation. And it's not just to get power, right? It's about having equal status, having the values that the best of religion is supposed to provide to society, and to bring ultimately, I think you know this word, sukoon, right? From Urdu, means peace of mind. Yeah. And every aspiration that I would have for humanity and individuals is to find peace of mind. If religion can be a pathway to it, great. If it's even non-religion and spirituality, if it's running, whatever it is, let us get to that place. But religion should not take it from us, you know, and it should not take life. It should not be used as an excuse to take life and to subject people to shame and second class status. And so that's how I had that real clarity. And going back to the idea of the Kundalini, what I did realize is you, in order to garner the strength and the power to do this, you do have to have a point of focus. And for me, that point of focus was always that shining smile of my friend Danny taken from this earth.
You've spoken about what the true intent and impact of religion should be in very beautiful words. I'm going to quote you here. You know, at one point you said, religion must be a vehicle for lifting the soul, not for suffocation. And then at another point you said, the purpose of religion is to inspire in us the best of human behavior. You know, I think these are simple yet so profound. And Asra, I want to continue with that story because you left it at a very provocative point where you were feeling a surge of a rebellious kind of an impulse from the vantage point of what the norms were, you know, in that mosque when you were seeking to want to just kind of enter it without being constrained to go down a different path that was required for women. So it seems to me like, you know, you've gone through an inner transformation by then, and now it's starting to get expressed in the form of some form of an outer transformation that you want to start to manifest and bring to the community to cleanse it in some ways of some of these either antiquated or blindsided aspects of blind faith, you know, that sometimes has really rigidified in not very positive ways, practices across the world, you know, across many faiths. And here you were facing and leaning into them in your own faith.
Every faith has, and every community has faced these challenges of rigidity for creating boundaries that are illogical and inhumane, ultimately. And in this journey, I went to Rome and I created my own heretics tour of every place where the church had killed somebody for challenging the orthodoxy. And you know, in India, we have also overcome so much that was in which religion was used, both in Hinduism and Buddhism, to put women on a second class status. And Judaism has also gone through various reforms. So I saw these lessons in other faiths and thought we can apply them within my own faith community, just like the Dalai Lama had told me, you know, on the banks of the Ganges River, to find peace within your own faith. And that's when I really confronted the institutions, you know, that prop up these boundaries. Because there are institutions that we oftentimes have to face when we want to challenge the boundaries. Because when you present it, you know, I know you know that people have to overcome fears, right? They have to overcome shame. They have to overcome the experience of being an outlier. You know, there's now, we're called change makers, right? When you disruptors, like there's nice words for the rebel. But oftentimes the rebel is the black sheep, as another metaphor. And so that is something that my family and I ended up confronting together. I ended up writing about these challenges. First, I wrote about the idea that a woman should never be killed or punished for giving birth, you know, without a wedding ring within my community. And then I argued in the page of the Washington Post that a woman should not have second class status at the mosque. And what I faced immediately was the assault of those folks that are, you know, the defenders of those boundaries. And how that played out in my own life, I'll never forget the day that this young man from the community took me to Panera Bread, I thought, you know, for a coffee. And what he was there was as a messenger from the elders. And he literally said to me, stop writing. You're bringing too much shame to the community. And I looked at him and I said, that's not possible. Like, I cannot stop. And, you know, we started off the conversation talking about voice. And voice, as we know, is, you know, physical, also it's external, but it in order to bring voice to ideas, to counterintuitive thoughts, you have to overcome so much within yourself too. It's a long and deep meditation. And that idea of the Kundalini energy that manifests as voice and as strong ideas comes from a deep meditation. And I had learned that meditative practices during my research into Buddhism and Tantra. And there on a rooftop in Dharamsala, where the Dalai Lama and the Tibetan Buddhist world has its home in exile, I had great meditations on really deep concepts like equanimity, where you have evenness in your emotional response to different experiences or people. Point of focus meditation, another one. On my drive to Chandigarh, I was learning was to look in the mirror and to actually smile at yourself, right? And to see the divine in yourself. So all those practices were now playing out for me as a Muslim feminist. You can't believe it, but when I went to the mosque, I would do the breathing exercises because I would sit in the men's section, as it was called, and with my mother, who would go with a hoodie as her headscarf. And she went there just to be somebody next to me. And I would do those exercises of the breath through my entire being. And I added to it, you know, the zikr, which is what we call the mantra, the repetitive words that we say on our fingers to steady my breath, you know, to overcome fear, because the men would then come over me, because I would be sitting on the carpet, and they would come over me standing, telling me, demanding that we leave. And we stood our ground and we stayed because we had an intellectual knowledge that this was our right within Islam and in the United States of America. But what it took, you know, emotionally was also that place that brings you to steady breath. And this became my work for the last, you know, decades now, to the point where today, thank goodness, the world hears the cries of the women in Iran for, you know, freedom, for women, for life. And we have not won this struggle at all in this community, but obviously also throughout the world. Like, this is still a constant struggle, but it is decades long and it'll be lifelong for me, I know, but with it comes that energy and that moment. That's why I related it to you getting off my motorcycle and sitting in the Rose Garden in Chandigarh, because everything that we can manifest in the world as we find the boundaries that we want to cross is informed by all those experiences and all the suffering and strength that we've garnered in the years before. So that's why I was so happy to, you know, kind of bring it to like the forefront, even here today and talking to you.
It's unfortunate, you know, we have those in history. You are certainly making history with so much of what you've just shared, you've been doing, who we might call reformers. And, you know, sometimes the defenders, as you said, of the status quo tend to see them as enemies of the faith. But on the other hand, these people, when they do their work from a deeply attuned place, are in some ways the ones who have the purest and deepest love for the faith, and perhaps are going to be the reason why the faith will continue to sustain, you know, century to century, because it has gone through those waves of reform to, yeah, dissolve those boundaries and eliminate those ossified sort of practices and continue to just help take people back to the source, back to the source, back to the source, where with, you know, I think the limitations of the human mind and institution building and the pursuit of power and all of that, pretty much in every faith, you see these cycles, you know, that it goes through where it sort of like gets very distant from the core, from the source.
You learn lessons from other sources, right, than the one that might manifest in your own life. And that's why I think my journey into Hinduism and Buddhism was so important. Because there, not personally and emotionally attached to difficulties that those fates have or have had, you know, in society, I was able to get lessons, like deeper lessons. I'll never forget, the first Hindu temple I went into was in Nepal, in Kathmandu. And it was such a foreign experience for me to go into a place of worship in my own native community, you know, of South Asia. And I walked in with no boundaries between male and female genders. You know, like there was men next to me, there were women next to me, there was no front door, back door. So I got to experience spiritualism and religion in my own, you know, ancestral community in a way that I had never experienced before, because even in so many mosques in Pakistan and India, women aren't even allowed to enter. So I had never even gone through that experience. And then I knew back at home that actually there was a separate area and there was a back door, and I didn't even bother to go through them after I'd had one experience at the big mosque, you know, on Massachusetts Avenue in Washington, D.C. At that mosque, women had to go into this trailer. So I walked into the mosque, the big gates, funded by all the governments of the world, the Muslim majority governments, and was told to go to this back trailer where I heard the sermon through this crackling speaker. And after that experience as a graduate student, I never went back. You know, like they had lost me as a community member. I was, you know, succeeding at the highest ranks of, quote, Western society, working at the Wall Street Journal, you know, interviewing President Clinton and traveling with the U.S. trade mission. But I couldn't even go into my mosque because I didn't want to be humiliated. So then here I am going to the Shaktipeets, you know, the temples of feminine energy, and being on the banks of the Kumbh Mela. And so there I was like, okay, now I can understand how actually it's not just about my culture, because these are people from my culture who are manifesting their religion in a different way. And I took all of that into then imagining a different reality based on also interpretation within Islam. And going back to like one example that I mentioned earlier that brought me so much pain, which was, you know, the expectation that I had absorbed that I had to marry a man within my faith. That meant that I got this invitation to go to the city of Doha in the state of Qatar in the Gulf, Persian Gulf area, and the Middle East. And it was a place that I didn't feel welcome, because this is a theocracy. You know, this is a place that has very strict hudud laws. And I said, anyway, I'm going to go, because it was an invitation to this debate called the Doha debate. And the debate question was that, do Muslim women have the right to marry anyone that they choose? For most people, you think it's a no-brainer. But within my community, as I had experienced, there was this expectation that you had to marry a Muslim man. So I went to the Nordstrom's. I got the most business-like suit I could think of and jetted to Doha, where I felt a lot of fear. You know, I did feel fear, because I knew that the law of that land was that a woman couldn't marry anyone that she chooses. And in fact, men couldn't marry anyone that they choose in many instances also. So I went there armed with intellect, right, of all the Quranic interpretations that I had read that said that actually a Muslim woman can marry outside the faith and she can marry anyone that she chooses. And I went with there with my story too. And we won. My side won. Because the people who voted were the people in the audience. And who was in the audience? Half of them were women. And they voted with us. And I felt everything else in life, that which we feel in our heart, many others also feel. And if we can just overcome our fears and get that voice, we can express for others what they may not yet be ready to express, but that together then we can collectively manifest once somebody breaks the silence.
That's a change maker right there. And I like to call it an inside out change maker, because you're not just speaking to policies and practices on the outside, but really to the heart on the inside, as you said. And that's so beautifully put. So beautifully put. You've continued to pursue this a little bit, right? Like you have, among other things, codified, you know, 99 precepts for opening hearts and minds and doors in the Muslim world. Can you talk a little bit about one or two examples of those precepts that you are really seeking to kind of, you know, just stir, you know, in the community?
Borrowing again from the journeys that others have made, this was a slogan of the Methodist Church here in the United States, because they too have been trying to manage, you know, a lot of issues of inclusion and equality and openness. And so why was the Methodist Church message close to home for me? Because that was one of the first places that my dad and the men at the mosque prayed. They got a room when they first arrived in West Virginia in Morgantown, and they got a room at the Methodist Church. They opened their doors to the Muslim community. But I don't even know if they knew that women weren't welcome at those prayers. And so when it came time for me to think about how we were going to manifest all of this reform theologically, I returned then to history. And though he has a kind of checkered history on some levels, Martin Luther, as many people know, brought Reformation to Christianity. And he had nailed these precepts to the door of a church. And so I had this idea, okay, I'm going to manifest our own precepts. And we have 99 names of God. One of them that is really important in all this type of work is Wadud, which is the Arabic word for love. And that's one precept that I'll focus on, because with the idea that, you know, we're all in a struggle, you know, everybody has a struggle in this world. Everybody is on their hero's journey, as you've put it. Religion should be a place, as you had read before, to bring us to a higher place of existence, of positivity and wellness from a place of love. And I had written, you know, this book, Tantrika, Traveling the Road of Divine Love. And love had manifested for me through my baby's life, through my parents' love for me, through the friendship that I had felt with my friend Danny. And I really felt like we had lost that North Star. And so that was the most fundamental idea. And from those 99 precepts, I also wrote a Bill of Rights. It was a Bill of Rights for women in the mosque and a Bill of Rights for women in the bedroom. Because from the public square to the intimate places of our lives, religion can express itself and it can control and define our lives. And it should bring us to a place of sukoon or peace of mind and spiritual wellness that I would hope for everybody. But what I had seen was that, in fact, through the crush of things like shame and demands and sacred boundaries of hudud, we were actually not realizing that full potential. And so that's why I wanted to, you know, not just be an activist like with action, but also give people ideas that they could then have as markers in their own lives, and then back them up with the theology to give them the argument when they have to talk in their own families and in their communities as they assert their rights. And so, you know, now today, interfaith marriage is much more accepted. You know, what else is accepted is even leaving the faith, atheism. And I have always extended, like, that wasn't the choice that I made, but I extend so much love to those who want to leave Islam, because I know that they just couldn't find hope. You know, there was just something in their own experience and in their own processing of what was possible that didn't give them hope. And yet there they are in this world, as important as anyone, right? And the other really important idea that I wanted to really manifest too was that in all philosophies of domination, we've had a hierarchy of human value, and that has expressed itself through various identity markers like your place of origin, your religion, your gender, your sexuality even. And I knew that the best of faith and the best of spiritualism is where we have no hierarchy of human value. And I had felt it on that motorcycle, that my Hero Honda Splendor, you know, with just the wind on my face and the sun on my eyes. You know, it was the possibility when we crossed those boundaries. And that's what I wanted to be able to share with everybody in this world, that that we can experience it, and that's actually something that we need to advocate, so that it's not just within my religion, but in all of humanity, so that we have this common humanity that believes in the divine in all people and the equality of all people and the spiritual power of all people.
So beautiful, so beautiful. You know, it just occurs to me that on that motorcycle, that Hero Honda, that was kind of like the start of your hero journey, right?
Oh, yes. Yeah.
So, so beautiful. And
part of the arc, yes.
I have been very inspired by studying the lives of Martin Luther King and Malcolm X and contrasting them, comparing them, correlating them. And I see some parallels, you know, in your journey with both of them. I mean, Martin Luther King had a similar crisis of faith, you know, in terms of how he was seeing Christianity being practiced and preached, you know, during his time. But that led him to redouble in his efforts to want to understand the true essence of what, you know, what was, you know, Jesus's message and his spirit, and, you know, is it being properly expressed, you know, in what we are being preached here, you know, in today's churches. And he ended up challenging, you know, some of those practices, not just in the white churches, but even in the black churches, and ultimately came to reaffirm, you know, his connection with the core, you know, of Christianity in a way that really became his foundation, right, for the rest of his life. Yeah. So I see that, right, in the journey that you made, and then you have Malcolm X, and he had the opposite sort of reaction, right? In his case, he chose to walk away from Christianity, you know, not seeing in it the satisfying resonance, you know, with his own intuition about what our relationship with humanity and the world should be. And then he makes his way into Islam, and then he preaches a certain gospel, a certain message from his side in terms of sort of how blacks and whites are meant to really be two very disparate and divided races. And then he goes to Mecca, you know, the same journey that you made, you know, as a devout Muslim. And he ends up getting so transformed there because he actually spoke about how he said, for the first time in my life, you know, I just felt complete, you know, as a human being. And I felt this great blanket of peace come over me and all of that. And so, and then he comes out from there with this much more universal, loving kind of new form, and painfully so, you know, he could only manifest that for a few months before he got killed. But that transformation for him at Hajj, his journey into the Islamic faith, and for Martin Luther King, you know, the reaffirmation of what true Christianity is really about, moving from, you know, like I call it, like from blind faith to true faith, right? Yeah, it's fascinating. It's fascinating to hear everything you've gone through.
I just want to add like another layer to it that I have only personally myself learned and discovered is I've learned and now read the lives of their mothers. And I definitely feel the parallel in their lives. But I also have another parallel because they manifested so much wisdom and power and clarity and strength from their mothers. Malcolm X's mother had been a warrior in her own way, sent to a psychiatric hospital because her type of rebellion, you know, was oftentimes institutionalized, especially when it expressed itself through women. Martin Luther King's mother was a pioneer in the civil rights movement herself and grounded her son in that challenge of doctrine that was conventional at that time. Because yes, and indeed, white churches would put blacks in a separate area, like women have had to experience in mosques. And that's how we really started recognizing not just, you know, separate and unequal in society, but separate and unequal as a part of religion is not okay also. But both of them, what I also think is so important is that both of them, what I find inspirational is that, like in Malcolm X's story especially, he did believe in that hierarchy of human value in his first incarnation within Islam. But then after he had his Mecca experience, he did come back with a sense of the humanity of people, you know, beyond identity markers. And of course, we know that's what Martin Luther King was preaching in valuing all children, right, by the content of their character. And so I think that's the lesson, you know, for all of us really, is how they went on their journeys and they challenged the inequities and inequalities in society, but believed in this value of human beings as equals and spiritual equals in this world. And that's so, to me, so important. And I know that's a philosophy that you believe, and I love hearing you manifest it, you know, in the most unconventional of ways, because you're in a universe of business and academics that isn't always gonna go there, right, in terms of spiritualism and higher being. But I so appreciate that you're charting that path for everybody. I really thank you for that work that you're doing, because not everyone can pull it off, and I'm so glad that you're doing it.
I'm so grateful. My motivation is similar to what you shared. You know, when you feel something in your heart, you know, you said it so much more eloquently. When you feel something in your heart, you are, you know, tuning into what others are feeling in their hearts. You know, it's.
I wanted to ask you, in your interview with Melissa, you talked about your father and the lessons that he gave you about serving humanity. I wanted to just ask you, if you don't mind, just sharing with us a little bit about your mother, because we're talking a lot about feminine energy and feminine spirit, and I bet she imparted a lot on you.
Yeah, I was in Chandigarh several months ago, and we happened to have a book talk for my recently published book, and you know, there was a question asked of me by the interviewer about her, because she was, you know, she was in the audience. My father has passed away, but she was there, and it was so hard for me to put in the finite form of words the full justice to what she has meant to me, continues to mean to me, and is for me. I mean, I think I basically reacted by sharing that my fondest memory in life is about these moments where I would return from school and just walk into her warm embrace.
Nice.
And you know, she would sit down, and sometimes it was just me, sometimes my sisters were there as well, because they, you know, returned from school, may have coincided, and feed us, and then listen to me and listen to us about, you know, our affairs in school and what happened, and just be such a joyful presence, a loving friend. And I remember that moment when I made a decision that I would, you know, after college, not continue to pursue higher studies in India or to pursue a career in India, but I would, you know, go on an adventure, truly fly out of the nest, you know, leave India to come to the United States and pursue higher studies. And I'm kneeling by her bed as she had just woken up from an afternoon siesta, and breaking the news to her that this is what was happening. And I remember her, you know, just taking a deep sigh. And in that moment, I don't think I recognize that as much as how over time I have looked back on that moment and understood what it signified for her. Because I think what it signified for her in that moment was that perhaps, like all these dreams that she had, that I would be kind of living somewhere within arm's reach, and would perhaps someday have my family, and that would be her family too, and that she would just always have me, you know, for the rest of her life to enjoy, that suddenly it may have emerged to her in that moment. And, you know, these were days when there still wasn't a whole lot of international travel that people do.
Right.
In fact, as a family, we just couldn't have afforded to buy a plane ticket, you know, for me to travel abroad. It just happened to be that I got a scholarship and we were able to do that. So the idea that somebody's going so far away was really not something that people just naturally acclimated to. And so for her in that moment, I think that, yeah, just reaction she did, she was just starting to recognize, like, oh my heavens, you know, maybe the whole of the rest of my life and the mental script that I played as to what it would be like now that my son is coming of age, maybe very different from what it's actually going to be. And yet she just looked at me and said, son, if it's going to make you happy, it's going to make me happy.
She said it in Hindi, right?
Yeah.
How did she say it in Hindi?
She would say like, tumhari khushi mein hi meri khushi hai.
Oh,
you know, so, in your joy is my joy.
That's so beautiful. And she, I'm feeling with her at the, as you tell the story, you know, that exercise that I knew I would have to do too, that is divine love, because she loves you so much that though it brings her pain to have you leave, she will experience this for your happiness and for your joy and for your choice.
I think I felt even more empathy with that once my daughter came to have us like settle her down in a dorm, you know, at college. Now the irony here is that we are living in New York and she goes to Columbia. So it's not, it's truly within arm's reach, right?
I said, right, so, but it's not under your roof.
That 30-minute walk. I came back home and I see her empty bedroom and I had tears in my eyes. My wife would console me.
You can just imagine, right? It's the late 80s, right? When you left.
Yes.
And I think we were still using the blue aerogram paper for letters.
Oh, yeah.
Remember? We had landlines. A phone call at 3 a.m. meant tragedy at home. And that's the future you were going off to, where you weren't going to meet her for a Starbucks coffee or, but I bet in her eyes too, you could feel that love and the strength, right? That everything that we've been talking about her in her life, she was manifesting, I'm sure, every practice that she had learned herself to be the strongest being that she could be as her son's about to set off.
Yeah. What a beautiful note for us to come to this culminating point in this conversation, which is a celebration of the feminine energy in the world, but also of mothers and just the caregiving and nurturing that we all so critically need in life, you know, that comes from that, you know, from that beautiful source. So perhaps to that end, I wonder, you know, Asra, if like we might bring our conversation to a point of closure by having you talk about your mother. And before you do that, I do want to say one thing, because, you know, just like you, I share this curiosity and an appreciation for, you know, the great faiths and all the great faiths. And I'm deeply, in so many ways, grateful for my Hindu faith and yoga and all that I've learned from it. At the same time, I just can't help but get so dazzled by so many beautiful, inspiring stories of, you know, the great ones from Buddhism and Christianity and Judaism and Islam and what have you. And Islam is like got so many such beautiful aspects to it. And some I just discover from time to time from talking to people like you. So many beautiful aspects. In particular for me, the notion of doing that namaz, you know, like 5 times a day, just staying anchored and re-anchored and re-anchored, and making it the foundation for everything that you do in life, to make it come from a very divine attunement, you know, that you're striving to have all the time. I mean, you know, the Sufi movement, for example, and the poetry and music of that time, I mean, it's intoxicating almost, you know, some of those things. So to me, you know, the work that you're doing is something I'm just so grateful for, you know, to seek to bring back that faith and its practitioners, you know, to their core, to the sweetest, most purest, you know, wellspring of that teaching. So, you know, so thank you, you know, for what you're doing.
Well, what's your mother's name?
Nirmal.
Nirmal?
Yeah.
Yeah, that's a really important name. What does that mean again?
Nirmal is, you know, Nirmalta, which means like softness, purity, gentility. And share yours as well. Share your mom's name. And
that's why I was wondering, because my mother's name is Sajida, means prostration. And I was just thinking about it when you were talking about the prostration and you were asking me about my mother too, because my mom is the inspiration in my life, honestly. She is so important to me as I go into the world. And I think what you were just saying about the caregiving and the love that our mothers provide, but they give us something else. And my mother gave me this, which is so important. And I know it had to have been true in your life too, is intellectual courage, you know, because when she set you off, you went on your journey of intellectual courage. And my mother grew up in a community and family in which she wore the full face veil and the burqa, the black gown, you know, from the time she was a teen. And she didn't want to do it, but she had to do it because that was the norm in the family. And then when she married into my father's family, they didn't expect it. My grandmother had actually been the first in our village, in our town of Azamgarh, to take off the veil. But my mom, when she came to the U.S., she wore like a lot of, she didn't know what the temperature, she's still like, says to my dad, he should have told me about winters in America. She came in a sari and sandals, and she worked first in her ancestry as a woman to work babysitting to raise the money from a ticket for my brother and me. And so she crossed those boundaries, you know, she crossed the hudud in a way that was so graceful and so smart and so dignified that she taught me by modeling for me that journey that we can make in our own lives, that it's possible. It, as children do, like my own crossing of boundaries manifested in a different way than hers did. But because she had overcome her own fears, she gave me the capacity then to overcome mine and to take action. And so I'm so lucky that I have my mother too in my life right now. She's in her 80s and my father is also in his 80s. And I just treasure them and cherish them. And, you know, to anybody listening who ever wonders, what we impart, you know, on each other is so important. And the role of parents is so critical. When my son left for college, I was in my room for days. I had lost my bearing. And then I started, you know, searching the stories of empty nesters. And I found that this was a universal experience from Australia to India. And then I learned it was timeless too, because there was this poem that I'll leave you with, I think is true about all of life and not just for parents. But in this poem by Khalil Gibran from Lebanon, he said that our children are the arrows and we are the bows, and our journey is to be the stable bows from which our arrows go into the world, and they will go into the world. But ours is to, I think, going back to what we began with and what we talked about throughout this whole conversation is, you know, to have that deep meditation, that deep reflection, so that Kundalini breath can express itself in the world in however our identities are manifested, whether as parents, as friends, as colleagues, as leaders, as community members, in whichever way it's possible. And I'm just so honored to have talked with you, because I know that you are in a constant journey manifesting that in the world for other people and for yourself. So thank you for having me be a part of your Hamsafar, as we call it, to journey together.
Been a real honor. I know for our listeners, as much as me as well, to have you on with us, Asra, and may you stay that, you know, steady bow. May you stay that steady bow, not just as your son keeps coming back to home and to recenter himself, but also for all of the other people whose lives you are shaping and influencing and will have deep, deep formative impact on. So thank you so much, you know, for keep doing your beautiful work and being that luminous light that you are.
Thank you so much.